The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Everybody experiences anxiety at some point. It's part of the human condition. Maybe it's a big presentation at work that has your stomach in knots, or your heart starts pounding in anticipation of a touchy conversation. It's all kind of normal. But for an estimated 25 million people affected by generalized anxiety disorders, even making a phone call can be debilitating. Trying to get out of the house in the morning can set off frightening physical responses like shortness of breath, and forget about trying to sleep. The overwhelming fear response associated with generalized anxiety disorder is not rational or explicable, but holds the dubious distinction of being the most frequently diagnosed mental illness in the U.S. today. Kat Kinsman is senior food and drinks editor for Extra Crispy. That's a website devoted to all things breakfast. She's also a commentator and public speaker on the topics of food and mental health. And her new book is High Anxiety, which explores her own struggles with anxiety. Kat, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've been writing about and living with anxiety for a long time. You decided to share your experience publicly while you were working at CNN. So why did you decide to go public?
Well, it was a tremendously open environment there. I was the food editor who would occasionally write about other things about, you know, I'd written previously about my experiences with depression. And the thing that happened when I did that was an incredibly warm and passionate and kind response from friends, coworkers, strangers. And I just felt like it was a thing that wasn't being talked about very much. And as soon as I opened that Pandora's box, it seemed like everybody I knew either suffered from this or somebody in their life did too. And I realized at one point over the holiday season a couple of years ago, my anxiety was something that I was keeping from the people even closest to me, and it was starting to affect my relationships. I wouldn't show up at a party or I would be late to something. And I felt like I finally had to come out and explain this. And I wrote a personal essay there that got a really wide response, and it just made me think we really have to talk about this.
So you didn't want to tell anybody. Once you did, everybody jumped on board. So guessing a lot of people really related to that.
Yeah, it's one of those things where we don't really have a good public picture of it. People think of, you know, they play it for comedy, this sort of, you know, neuroses of, you know, somebody is super nervous. But the thing is, there's probably somebody within, you know, a 25-foot radius of you who at some point in the recent past has had a panic attack or woke up in the middle of the night or had or is having a huge problem making phone calls. But it's for some reason, it feels really shameful. And a lot of people, you know, people around me were saying, well, you know, really, I didn't expect you were an anxious person because you can go on TV easily or get on a plane, whatever it is. But I have sometimes difficulty leaving the house. And that's mortifying because there are millions of people who achieve exactly that every day. So I kept it really close to the vest until I realized it was going to help other people if I talked about it, too.
In fact, you write about feeling as if the house had you in its jaws, sinking its teeth into your hem, your skin. A pretty powerful and scary image. That's one particular experience with anxiety. How does it normally manifest for you?
Well, there is no normal, really. For me personally, it happens a lot when I am trying to leave the house and I'll start to sweat and my hands will shake and I'll try to get to the door and then I'll be very clumsy and I'll drop something, I'll forget something. And it just becomes this almost impenetrable barrier. Or what happens a lot is that I'll wake up in the middle of the night with my heart pounding and feel like something is smashing down onto my chest. And all of a sudden, my head will start to think like, gosh, what do I have to do at work today? You know, what is the thing I have to do after work? And I get in the physical manifestation for me often is, you know, I have difficulty breathing, my stomach hurts, or I claw at my thumb a lot. And it's funny, I know a lot of people have that behavior and I can kind of look around and look at people's thumbs and see where they are on the anxiety spectrum. But it manifests differently for different people.
And this is part of human biology. Our minds are literally on the lookout for danger all the time and sometimes create danger. But those physical feelings of anxiety, those are real, those are measurable, and can really have detrimental effects on the body. Like what?
Well, just in the past few weeks, I've had several different friends go to the ER for panic attacks. They thought they were dying. There's something in them convinced them that they were having a heart attack, that there was something going on. They couldn't breathe. They had palpitations. After a while, it becomes really debilitating. I grind my jaw, so, you know, I find that I have tremendous headaches and neck aches. Other people have severe gastric problems. You know, after a while, when you are in startle mode all the time, when you are hunched up and waiting for something to happen, it doesn't even have to be related to anything. You just know that you're frightened and afraid, and your body is telling you it has this extreme fight or flight response. You wear down after a while.
Well, you said if depression is a black dog, then anxiety is a feral cat. I think it's hard for a lot of people to imagine how that feels. I mean, our culture is very attached to this idea of all of us being able to handle it all. We're attracted, right, to the idea or the veneer of calm, which means competence. So how does this stigma that you're talking about, this kind of aloneness, relate to that anxiety?
Well, you get really, really good at hiding, and it becomes this sort of compounded burden because you don't want to inflict this on other people. You don't want them to have to worry about you. You don't necessarily want to be thought of as crazy or incapable or any of these other things that, you know, we have. Our culture collectively has this really macho notion of how we're all supposed to be. We don't want to be thought of as weak or troubled or any of these sorts of things. But I think we can reframe the conversation and say that for people with any of these disorders, anxiety, panic, depression, OCD, any of these things, to be able to go out into the world while you're suffering through this and just be a person takes more courage and strength than anybody could possibly know. And so I think if we normalize the conversation about this, then people will see it for what it is. I mean, I keep thinking about the word, tough and the word decent. I think we're all so invested in showing our toughness. What we need to do is show our decency to other people and let them know that they are safe and they are not alone, and that even if somebody is having problems, we're all there for each other.
So what has writing about anxiety and talking about it done for you? How has that changed your relationship to your anxiety?
It's been a tremendous thing. I mean, writing the book was a really difficult thing to do because I had to go and relive my most anxious possible moments. But what happened while I was doing it was I was able to identify a certain amount of patterns in my life and see how I react in situations where I I anticipate trouble that isn't necessarily going to be there, or I think the worst possible thing is going to happen, and sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. And I've been able to really go in and change some of my patterns. But even more so, I'm able, since I've been analyzing my own patterns, to identify them in other people and just offer a word of kindness, not even identify the problem. But, you know, I might be irritated that somebody is late with doing something, or they're doing some particular thing. I can backtrack and realize, oh, maybe something else is afoot. And it's given me so much more patience with other people. And I've sort of made it my mission to try to just make a calmer, better world around me. And it really, really is contagious. Kindness and empathy are contagious. And we all need a whole lot more of that right now.
Kat Kinsman is with me. She's a food writer, commentator, and author of the book High Anxiety, Life with a Bad Case of Nerves. That's high, comma, anxiety, in case I didn't specify that well enough. How about some of the other ways that you actually treat your anxiety? What has helped for you?
Well, I love therapy, and I've been going to therapy on and off since I was diagnosed with depression at age 14. So, you know, that's usually been cognitive behavioral therapy, and I had one therapist who really enjoyed hypnosis. And otherwise, you know, medication works really well for a lot of people. I ended up having a very not great experience with it, so it's not a route I really feel I can take. But for some people, it's been a godsend and a lifesaver. So for me, I use a dietary supplement called L-theanine, and it's tea leaf based, and it really helps in the middle of a panic attack to help me calm down a little bit. I also concentrate a whole lot on breathing. just being really, really conscious of it, taking 3 deep breaths in through the nose and out through the mouth. And I find that it really sort of resets my brain and centers me. I work with a lot of different groups, especially chefs, who feel like they don't have a single second to calm down during the day. And I tell them, look, breathing is free. You know, your lungs are with you all day. You might as well use them. And just taking that moment to stop and be conscious of your breathing is tremendously helpful.
I'm glad you mentioned the chefs, because Chefs with Issues is a website that you started. It's kind of a forum for chefs and others in the food business to share their stories and to address the mental health crisis in the food community. What is the connection between chefs and food and mental health?
It's amazing. It's sort of a chicken and egg in that a lot of people who suffer from various mental health issues are drawn to kitchen life because of there's a lot of order to it, and there's also a lot of acceptance from people who maybe didn't find their place in the world in a traditional 9-to-5 career. They find acceptance in the kitchen. And they find their people. And the problem is the life sort of exacerbates then bad habits, drinking, lack of self-care, sometimes substance abuse. And there's a tremendously high rate of suicide in the industry as well. People don't have insurance. They don't have the kind of a culture where people can talk about it either, because it is a really very, very macho culture where you have to be tough and fast, and there isn't any time to talk about how you're actually feeling, and you don't get any days off. So last February, there were at least three suicides that I knew about from chef owners in the industry. And I decided that we really needed to talk about this. So I put out a survey about issues that people were having in the food world, and opened it up. I thought I would get a few dozen responses, and at this point, I have over 1,500 responses. Wow. To this. All chefs and people in the food industry talking about what they're up against. So, mm-hmm. It's really real, and luckily, people are starting to talk about it and helping each other.
Well, it also leads us to this idea of comfort food. Food is something mm-hmm. that we gather around that makes us happy, that comforts us, especially when it's getting cold and dark. So what food brings you comfort?
Well, it's funny. The website I write for is All Breakfast. So
yes, we are big fans of all things breakfast and that website, Extra Crispy, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Well, we have a great time doing it. And so I've been writing a lot about what to eat in the morning if you have panic, if you have depression. And a lot of it, I've been really, really hooked on oatmeal with hot sauce in it. Because isn't it funny? It's like oatmeal has some properties that soothe the brain and the various systems. And then hot sauce gives you this little endorphin kick. That's a really great way to start the day. Avocados and smoked salmon have a lot of really brain beneficial things that help you just get off to a better start during your day.
Yeah. And Is it the routine as well?
The routine is fantastic. I've started meeting friends or colleagues in the morning for breakfast. By the end of the day, I'm sort of worn out and stressed. But if you make a plan to meet somebody first thing in the morning, especially if it's somebody you love, it really just, it lights the rest of the day. It sets a fantastic tone for the day.
Well, even for people who do not have anxiety disorders, the holidays can be really difficult. So do you have any advice for people who are dreading the family gatherings, dinner tables, or, all of the other stuff that comes with it?
Yeah, I think, first of all, have compassion for the people around you, even if you don't suffer this yourself. If you're in a room with 5 other people, there's a chance that there's at least one other person who is suffering from this too. Like I say, kindness is free and it is contagious. What I've been telling people is that we all really need to check in on each other and ask people if they're okay and be prepared for them to say no. And, what's the worst that's going to happen? It gets a little bit awkward. That's okay. That's better than somebody suffering in silence. So the other things you can do to my former therapist had a great thing that he called magic bubble, where you just imagine yourself within a bubble. And you can let in whomever you want to, and the bubble keeps the sort of discomfort on the outside of it. So you can just sort of vision this, like these words that are coming toward me that might be hurtful, they can just stop somehow a little bit away from you. They don't actually touch you. If you can envision this happening, practice a little bit before you go into an uncomfortable situation and say magic bubble, magic bubble, magic bubble to yourself in your head. It sounds so silly, but it's actually really highly effective. And the thing is, once you're done, you can leave, ideally. If you're having an uncomfortable time, you can it has an end point. You can leave. It's all going to be okay. You can go back to your own life, and you don't have to let it touch you. I know that's really hard to do, but if you can practice that before you go, it's a really good thing to do.
Well, glad we got into the bubble today, Kat. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Kat Kinsman, Senior Food and Drinks Editor for Extra Crispy. That is a website devoted to all things breakfast. Her new book is called High Anxiety, Life with a Bad Case of Nerves. You'll find a link to read more on the book and her work at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The ongoing battle between law enforcement and about 400 people protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline erupted again this week. The Morton County Sheriff's Department defended its use this weekend of a water cannon on the crowd as crowd control and to extinguish fires started over the weekend. A spokesman for one of the indigenous groups protesting under the hashtag NoDapple said that activists had lit two bonfires to stay warm and to cook in the freezing cold. To better understand the bitter land use and rights dispute that has been going on for generations, cartographer Carl Sack headed to Standing Rock Reservation. To get there, he relied on a hand-drawn map that a friend had posted on Facebook. And once there, he started working on a new map of the site where thousands of Native Americans and their allies have been protesting. Carl, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
There are plenty of maps of the area, but you made your own. So what did that reveal about the conflict?
Well, first, I want to just, you know, correct something that to make sure that we have the details right, which is that the pipeline route itself does not run through the current Standing Rock Reservation. It runs only a couple miles away from the reservation boundary is where it crosses Lake Oahe, where they will drill under Lake Oahe. And that's just a few miles upstream of the water intake for the Standing Rock Reservation. Now, what it does go through is territory that was designated by the 1851 Treaty of Fort Laramie as Sioux Territory. This is a historic treaty, peace treaty, between the United States government and the Sioux that sought to stop the fighting between the Sioux tribes themselves and other tribes and between them and the U.S. government. And it's never been legally superseded. It wasn't a treaty of cession. It did not give up Sioux lands. It designated lands as Sioux lands. And no legal treaty between the United States and the Sioux ever since has given up that land.
There are two different pipeline routes here. There's one that was the original pipeline route and then the proposed pipeline route, with quite a difference in between them. And what does the revelation of those two show us on your map?
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So the originally proposed route went a few miles north of Bismarck, North Dakota. And Bismarck and Mandan, which is right next door, are majority white communities. And the Army Corps of Engineers, after hearing public feedback, essentially said, no, you can't use that route because a number of reasons, one of which being that it threatens the water supply in the event of a breach. So they viewed this alternative route, the current route, as a better alternative, and that goes south of Bismarck and Mandan, but crosses the Missouri River under Lake Oahe, which is a dam part of the Missouri River, much closer to the water intakes for the Standing Rock Reservation. So a lot of people have pointed to this as an example of environmental racism. And I want to say, too, that I think that the people of Bismarck and Mandan have every right to clean water, just as the people of Standing Rock have every right to clean water. What I hope for my map is that it doesn't give the impression that people were wrong to demand that the pipeline route not put their water supply at risk. My intent is simply to show that there seems to be a double standard at work here, and if one community's water supply at risk is a problem, then we should consider all risk to water a problem.
So Energy Partners, Energy Transfer Partners, the company behind this, has its own map of the pipeline route. In the article that you wrote, that we found, you take issue with it. What's wrong with their map?
First of all, it's what we cartographers call very small scale. In other words, it's zoomed out and covers a very large area. So it's hard to see the communities that would be affected by that pipeline. But on top of that, what you see, if you look at this map, which you can easily find on Google, is that they've put pink polygons that are the shapes of all of the counties the pipeline route goes through. So what that does well is it highlights which county jurisdictions might have some say over the pipeline route or something to say about that route. What it doesn't really take into account, though, is that those polygons, those pink shades, obscure all of the cities and towns and smaller Indian reservations that might be there. It kind of covers over the landscape, so you can't even see what communities that people are actually living in that the pipeline passes through.
So by having a better map, what happens?
I've been really inspired by Professor Zoltan Grossman's quote that the side with the best maps wins. And what that says to me is that when you tell people a story about the spatial relationships of places that are at risk from resource extraction, from mining, from pipelines, from railroads, what have you, it reveals a whole new dimension to whatever conflict it is or whatever issue is at hand. Maps really have power to visually demonstrate what is at risk when you're talking about an environmental issue like Dakota Access Pipeline. Yeah, you have pictures of police and riot gear facing off with protesters, video of police using water cannons on protesters, of protesters locking themselves to equipment. And that's all great and tells one story. But unless you zoom out a little and tell the broad spatial story of what's going on where and what is at risk where, it's hard to really understand what the stakes are.
Carl Sack, a cartographer and a grad student at the University of Wisconsin's Department of Geography. Carl, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
You can find a link to his article and take a look at his No Dapple map at Standing Rock at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's time for Overheard, our regular segment for sharing the intriguing and moving and baffling and frequently hilarious audio that we come across. And today we're kicking off our Zero Politics edition with executive producer Maureen McMurray, our senior producer Taylor Quimby, and with me, who was shamed into not using a piece of tape that mentions civics education. Like, that's political.
Yeah, well, you did say, at some point we said, well, does it mention either of the candidates that just either won or lost for the presidency? And you said maybe. Or would you say
I cut it out.
It doesn't count.
Okay. So what have we got instead?
I'll go first. I've got a string of things, and this is a little bit of a theme. Basically, it has to do with my fascination with TV themes and movie scores. So I'm going to start with something that you guys have probably heard before. This is a cover of the Westworld theme by this woman named Anastasia Sowina. And it's basically this like maybe not new, but it's a genre of YouTube video where somebody records themselves playing all the different parts of a certain piece of music. So you sort of see something like 9 different camera views of this woman playing a violin. And it's just beautiful rendition of a very cool TV theme. Yeah, so
that is beautiful.
Yeah, it's cool. And it's such a cool example of fandom and to me, this idea of the strangest way that people can make money doing music today, you know, this is what an odd gig. She does this for like video game scores and.
Oh, wait, so she makes money off of this?
Oh, sure. Yeah. She's got a huge YouTube following.
Oh.
She's basically a type of YouTuber. And there are others. There's a guy who does a cappella versions of video game songs that I'm kind of a big fan of. And he just, yeah, he records himself doing all the parts. It's really amazing.
Very cool. Do you watch Westworld, by the way?
I haven't. I'm planning on it.
It's great.
Yeah.
Especially the bing, ding, 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 ding. That's played by a skeleton's fingers.
Ooh. Ooh.
It's a great shot.
Okay, my second one fitting this theme as well is a version of the Stranger Things theme that was transferred into the major key. So it sounds like a really upbeat 80s or 90s track.
And let's just mention that Stranger Things was a Netflix series that was kind of an ode to the horror movies of the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, totally awesome. Theme was really great. I think it was by the Dust Brothers. But this brings it a whole new light. It's just happier. It's like the sequel season could be a comedy.
That sounds so hopeful.
I know.
I wonder if we should hear the original just for a comparison.
Well, would you like to? Because I can line that up. Yeah, that's gritty. Ooh, it's so good.
Okay, Taylor Crimmer, you get big points for just completely avoiding anything political.
That's how I do it.
This is the politics-free zone version of Overheard. What have you got, Maureen?
So I have a couple of clips from a new podcast out of WBEZ in Chicago called Making Oprah. It's new. It's brand new. It is the 30th anniversary of the Oprah Winfrey Show, and they just decided to do a three-part series diving into the history of Oprah and how she became who she is today. It's fascinating. There are all of these things that I didn't realize about her career and her rise to fame and how the show has evolved over the years. And the first clip I'm going to play is a moment in the podcast from the first episode when the host discovers that they have caught the big kahuna.
So, news.
Yes. That's my producer, Colin. He'd spent a couple of months trying to book one particular interview for this project, and finally, he had some news.
We have Oprah.
Okay, my... Are you serious?
Yeah. I just spoke to her assistant, and Oprah can do this coming Monday in L.A., so we're going to meet Oprah. No.
Oh,
so that's happening.
Oh, my gosh.
Yay.
Oh, my gosh. Colin. Okay, hold on. I've got to get my, I've got to center, Jennifer. Center yourself. I know that reaction was a bit much, but here's what you have to understand. I'm a 40-something-year-old Black woman who spent her career working in the media. Oprah means a lot. And as you can imagine, she's not the easiest interview to get. So when you land an interview with Oprah and you recover from the shock, here's what you do. You get a pedicure because you're going to wear open-toed shoes. You buy a new dress, nothing too fancy, but it's new. You fly to Los Angeles. You drive to Warner Brothers Studios, where the season premiere of The Ellen DeGeneres Show is being filmed. You're led to your dressing room, next to the one occupied by actor Channing Tatum and Olympic gymnast Simone Biles.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so there's going to be a lot of background noise. Never mind, you press on, setting up your recording equipment.
This is the mic where Oprah speaks.
Testing the mics like good public radio producers do.
This is the mic where Oprah will speak early.
You watch the stage feed on a TV in your dressing room and see Ellen introduce Oprah.
Right now, you can see one of my co-stars from Magic, Michelle, right now. Get your dollar bills ready for Oprah Winfrey, everybody.
You watch the audience going nuts, screaming, "Oh my God, it's Oprah!"
Well, let me just say, 14 years, I know what that is. Congratulations.
Wow. Yeah.
And you watch Oprah walk off stage knowing that she's headed for your dressing room.
Oprah, okay.
Then Oprah walks in.
Oh, wow, you set that clip up good, Maureen.
I just love it so much because it really breaks down the fourth wall and it really shows that there's something magic about Oprah. And I can say for us, if we booked Oprah on the show, we'd have the same reaction.
I was wondering about that. Can anyone who's not a producer understand the joy of that, the zeal?
The next clip speaks a little bit about the evolution of the show. So back in the early 80s, it started in 1986. When Oprah started, if people may not remember this, but she would often have pretty provocative topics, have, you know, cheating husbands and things like that. And then she went to...
You mean like Jerry Springer style?
Yeah. A little more down market, huh?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so like this whole, you know, live your best life, that was not something that was explicitly stated at the beginning, and the show evolved in that way, really under Oprah's leadership. At the beginning, she kind of wanted it to be that, but felt the pressure of ratings to make it exciting daytime television. So in 1987, she went to Forsyth County in Georgia, which had experienced, there was a hate crime in 1912 because of that, this once integrated community completely fractured. And at this point, when she goes to visit Forsyth County, it's all white. And she decides that she's going to have a series of shows that she broadcasts there, bringing the community together to talk about race relations. It goes really well. Everything, you know, gets great ratings. People in the community feel that there's been this healing. So after that, she decides that she wants to kind of continue to have these difficult conversations, and this next clip is one of those conversations.
I actually, for a long time, thought that through the process of conversation, I could break down barriers of racism or homophobia or ideas that people had that were, you know, discriminatory toward other people. And it was the revelatory moment with the skinheads, actually, on the show, that I realized the power of the platform.
February sweeps period, 1988. Oprah versus skinheads.
My guests today call themselves skinheads. They say their heads are shaved for battle and that they must save the white race from communists and homosexuals.
If Forsyth County counted as a big win in what the Oprah Winfrey Show was able to expose, the skinheads episode was racked up as a definite loss.
I just heard what you said. You just said, I don't sit with monkeys. You think because she's black, because I'm black, we're monkeys? Is that?
That's a proven fact.
That's a proven fact? It's a proven fact that I'm a monkey?
Could be, but, you know.
Go ahead.
First thing I want to get off my mind is...
No, I want to talk about this monkey stuff.
These skinheads...
We don't want any red skin. I'm like, you in America.
If everybody's going to talk at one time, nobody's going to be heard.
I support black.
Sit down. Sit down. I'll take a break. I'll be right back.
During a commercial break, I saw them signaling each other with their hands and making signs and saying, yeah, get her, and that kind of thing. I went, whoa. I think I'm doing one thing. I think I'm exposing them. I think I'm showing them and their vitriol and their dark side and trying to get them to see a different point of view. And they are using me.
How did that feel?
It was a huge revelation. Like, whoa, I think I'm doing good here and I'm not. This energy is going out into the world, and I am the one who is responsible for that.
Oprah's agenda for this show was hijacked. She'd lost control, and she walked off stage determined that it would never happen again.
I went to the producers after that show and said, this is it for me. I will not be used by anybody again for presenting darkness in the world.
One of many very, very pivotal moments, and it's worth noting, too, that it was after that episode that Geraldo Rivera also invited skinheads to his show. There was a big melee. He was hit in the face with a chair, broke his nose, and got really great ratings. But her rating suffered after this, after she made the transition to, you know, live your best life. But she really stuck to her vision for the show, and it's just an incredible exploration of her career.
So that was Maureen McMurray, her overheard pick, Making Oprah. This is out of WBEZ. I chose also another podcast. It's from Gimlet Media, and it's a new one called Crime Town. It's a 17-part series about the history of organized crime in Providence, Rhode Island. And it's created by Zach Stewart Pontier and Mark Smerling. So they produced The Jinx, Remember the Lives and Deaths of Robert Durst. And this is just a fascinating story because I've always heard about, you know, Buddy Cianci and like he's the mayor, you know, convicted felon, longtime mayor of Providence, and has a long simmering feud with the mob boss Raymond Patriarca, head of what was then the most powerful criminal empire in New England. He ruled from Federal Hill. You know, the mayor ruled from City Hall, and he was very corrupt. They begin the episode with a testimony from someone talking about, you know, Buddy Cianci kicking him, burning him with a cigarette, swinging a fireplace log at him. It was just crazy. But I really love the second part because it was called Climbing the Ladder, and you get this glimpse of the kind of inner workings of this vast patriarcha crime empire through two guys who kind of become enforcers and make their way up through the ranks, Bobby Wallison and Jerry Tillinghast. So here is Bobby, the one of the hosts. I think it's Zach, goes back to his painful childhood, both kids. But Bobby, he grew up in Oakland Beach. This is kind of seedy, you know, a shore town near Providence. And he's sharing his first memory of his dad.
First memory?
Yeah.
When he picked me up and threw me into the air, and I landed on a mattressless, remember the iron springs back in the day? And it broke my nose. And I was two. I remember the blood. Remember the blood dripping? That was my first real memory of my father.
So, when he was old enough, Bobby ran away from home.
I ended up sleeping on the hill at Merino Park, having to steal clothes off the clotheslines. Okay, I'll take this sweater. Let's grab that blanket so we can sleep in our box, a cardboard box. It was tough. It was tough. And I got a little bit harder every day. It seemed like I got harder and harder. And I said, at 12 years old, man, I felt like I was 40.
So Bobby and Jerry, they're both in prison as teenagers. They meet each other. They talk about the rough cruise that they ran for the patriarchal family, all the muscle, all the violence, and why they thought they were living the life.
In that day, being a wise guy was the coolest thing on the planet. There was nothing cooler. Movie stars wanted to be around them.
That's what you call in the business, good tape.
Really good tape. They get a lot of really good tape for this. But you know, it's funny because last week I had to drive to Hanover and I was listening to Terry Gross's interview with Francis Ford Coppola about The Godfather. The notebooks that he kept during the making of The Godfather are now reproduced and out as makes a great Christmas gift, I imagine. But you know, this kind of fascination with the mafiosi and this kind of glamorous veneer of them. There was a point when John Gotti wanted to meet him. He came up to one of his trailers, you know, on a film that he was working on, really wanted to meet him. And Coppola said, like, no way in the world. You know, I am never going to meet these guys. They're not glamorous people. They're not nice people. They're the most twisted manifestation of humanity that you can imagine. So I just thought, this is a real person, kid, who became an enforcer.
Yeah. I'm actually pretty impressed that we all managed to avoid politics with this week's Overheard.
Yeah, I think everyone's looking for distractions. If you've got some you want to suggest, send them in. We're at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Poddington Bear, Blue Dot Sessions, and Broke for Free. And if you're looking for something to add to your Thanksgiving Drive playlist, consider subscribing to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can find it by searching Word of Mouth, NHPR, in iTunes or Google Play.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and I will be driving all day tomorrow. Taylor Quimby will be in this seat at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio. In the meantime, I wish you a happy, healthy, safe, abundant, and not too stuffed Thanksgiving.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.